This is The Thirsty Developer, episode number 60 for Monday, April 27th, 2009, SQL Server 2008 for developers. This week we have a great interview with Chuck Heinzelman, a Microsoft MVP on SQL Server. Chuck shares with us some of the great new features of SQL Server 2008 that are more developer-focused. Let's listen to the interview. I'm here with my buddy Chuck. Chuck, can you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Chuck Heinzelman. I'm a senior database administrator with Big Hammer. I'm also a SQL Server MVP.
So you've done a presentation locally here a couple of times, you know, both to the SQL Server user group and the .NET user group, and it was really well received, you know, in both cases. I wanted to go ahead and record this for the podcast because a lot, even though you're, you know, come from the more the DBA side of the house, that what you've been talking about is new features in SQL Server 2008 for developers.
Correct. What I decided to do, when I try to learn a new technology, one of the things I like to do is come up with a real-world practical application. I don't want to just build a hello world application with it that's not going to do anything for me. So I decided to build an online recipe box.
Okay.
We all have that box of recipes or the drawer full of recipes that were cut out of magazines that when you're looking to make something, you have to find the recipe and then find all the ingredients and work through that. I wanted to make that electronic, partially to use new features of SQL Server, partially to make my wife happy because I've been promising her this. I would do it for years, and
okay.
I'm finally getting to it. I looked at the new features of SQL Server that are, you know, there's a lot of back-end features that are performance-related, but there's also a lot of developer-related features.
Right.
So the application builds on sparse columns, column sets, table-valued parameters, new transact SQL statements, using file stream data where you can go right to the file system without having to go into SQL Server, and believe it or not, I've worked spatial data into a recipe box.
Really?
Yes.
All right. So let's actually talk about some of the features and how you've exploited them in this sample application. So,
okay.
Where'd you start? What was the first one that you said, "Let me take advantage of this one"?
The first one I jumped on is sparse columns.
Okay.
Sparse columns are, it's an extension of a normal column in a table where right now you, or with 2005 and non-sparse columns in 2008, you can have a null column. But that null column still takes up space in your database.
Right.
If you have a four byte integer that's null, it's still going to take up 4 bytes. What sparse columns does is there's still overhead with dealing with sparse columns, but if the column is actually null, it takes up less space than if it's not null. So where without sparse columns, you're still using the same amount of space. With sparse columns, you can use less space if you have high levels of nullability. And in SQL Server Books Online, there's actually a chart for each data type saying that if you are a certain percent null or greater, you will benefit from using sparse columns because of the overhead.
Right.
So I thought about how I could use sparse columns. And immediately what came into my head was ingredients. And specifically with ingredients, if you look at the nutritional information on anything you buy, some of them have a lot of information filled in, all the vitamin mineral content. Some of it has very sparse information filled in there.
Right.
So what I did with the ingredients is I made a list of all of the possible nutritional information for a given ingredient, and all of those columns are sparse. So if the ingredient has it populated, I can fill it in. If it doesn't, I don't fill it in and don't take the storage penalty on the null columns.
Okay.
Another thing that actually helps with sparse columns is they've introduced a tool called column sets. Now, column sets ride over the top of a group of sparse columns in your table. Where column sets really benefit developers is if you select a column set and have it come out into your application, it returns all of the populated columns as XML.
Okay.
Which developers...
We love XML.
Love XML.
Right.
It's easy to parse in .NET, really easy to work with. The nice thing about column sets as well is when you're putting data away, when you take the, let's say you take your XML column set, you shred it, you put it into a form, the user alters the data in the form. When you put it back into the XML to pass it into SQL Server, if the user doesn't fill in a particular value, you just leave it out of the XML, and even if it was there before, SQL Server will now null it out. So column sets come out as XML and go back in as XML for your updates and inserts.
Yeah, and when you're describing sparse columns, the first thing that came to my mind was oftentimes on an application that you'll have a description field, you know, about something. You'll have a required piece of information, but you'll have a very free-form, long, you know, text field associated with that where somebody can describe it.
Mm-hmm.
I run into this, quite a bit as you're doing applications. Invariably, 90% of the time, the user doesn't put anything, you know, in that text field.
Right.
So this would be an obvious use case to say that make that a sparse column.
Right.
You know, and again, I can go to books online and see what the percentage is, right? But I got to think with a text field, particularly if I give them like, you know, 4,000, you know, bytes of character space to fill in, that's I'm going to have a real penalty there unless I make, well, I guess if I make it a varchar.
If you make it a variable width, it's not going to be as bad, but right. It still needs to account for that.
It still takes up space, yeah.
Right.
Column set, you know, with the XML, I think it'd be really powerful when you combine that with like link to SQL. Right.
Yes.
Because I got to think that that's a data type that I could instantly, you know, use link to SQL to do, you know, queries on.
And when the example application I've built here actually just uses ADO.NET, and it comes out just as an XML data type. It just comes out as XML, goes back in as XML.
Okay.
So it works out really, really well.
Cool.
The next thing I thought about, so that took care of my sparse columns and my column sets. The next thing I wanted to go down was a new Transact SQL element that was added in 2008 called Merge.
Okay.
Now, Merge was teased in the 2005 version. It was in some of the early beta builds, and then it didn't make the final cut for the product.
Right.
So it's part of the ANSI standard. We've been waiting for it for years. What you can do with Merge is you can operate on data as a set, where you have inserts, updates, and deletes all together in a set, and have it, you know, the way you have to deal with it without the merge statement is you have to see, does this row exist? If it exists, update. If it doesn't exist, insert. And you have to maintain a transaction around all that. It becomes a real mess. Plus, you end up doing things row by row.
Right.
Where with the merge statement, you can take an entire set of data that some of it might be inserts, some of it might be updates. Say, operate on this set. If you find it, update it. If you don't find it, insert it. That's part of the next example that I came up with, is using the merge statement. But from the application side, the problem comes in, how do I get that set into the database to begin with?
Right.
And that's where a new technology called table value parameters comes in. Table value parameters on the SQL Server side look to the database engine like a normal table. You can select from them, work with them as a normal table, with one restriction that they're read-only.
Okay.
But what you can do from the .NET side is when you pass a table value parameter in, the way you get it into SQL Server is pass anything that inherits from a .NET data table. You add a data table to your ADO command as a parameter, and that goes into SQL Server as a table value parameter, and it can work on the entire set as a table.
Okay.
So what I did with the application is I built the screens where I deal with setting up a recipe and saying what ingredients are in the recipe. They are all meant to be completely disconnected. And this is great for a smart client application where you're sometimes connected, sometimes not.
Absolutely.
You can work on entire sets at a time, and it makes it a lot easier. What I did with this is when you're setting up a recipe, you go and you put in the static properties about a recipe, but then you add a list of ingredients. Well, that list of ingredients gets put into a .NET data table and passed into a stored procedure as a table value parameter. So then I can take that one recipe, the recipe ID, and say use the merge statement to work with this list of ingredients and store them properly. Now, the merge statement allows you to say, you define what your keys are for matching to your underlying table from what was passed in. And then you can say, when I find a match, perform this action.
Okay.
Could be an update, could be, you know, whatever you want to do. You perform a certain action on records that match up between the source and the destination. You can also say when it's not matched because it's in the destination but not in the source. So it's in the table that's currently in the database, but it's not in what was passed in.
That's a delete operation, right?
You can choose to ignore it, or you can perform a delete right there.
Okay.
You have to be careful with the deletes because you could accidentally delete more than you plan to. But yeah, it's you just have to make sure you're careful and cognizant of that.
At that point, you're down to domain design, right?
Exactly.
You know, so am I going to allow people to do deletes in a lazy fashion, right?
Correct. Yeah. And then you can also get into the other clause you can say is when it's not matched because it's not in the target but it is in the source, that becomes an insert.
Right.
So you can combine these in whatever fashion you'd like to meet your business needs. But the nice thing is if you pass in a data table that has 100 rows in it to operate on, all 100 act as a atomic transaction. You don't have to do a begin transaction, commit transaction. That one statement, it's either going to commit or it's not, all as a whole.
Right. And that's really powerful when you talk about, you know, data is becoming more of, you know, we're not dealing with individual records so much anymore. We're dealing with a lot of data. And there's a real performance value in, you know, if I look at adding a new recipe, let's stick with the mm-hmm. example that you built in, right? And if I have 60 ingredients, right, which is a really complex recipe, let's change it. So if I have 20 ingredients in a pie that I'm going to do,
right?
In the old days, I would have to insert the recipe record, you know, get the identity there, and then add the 20 individual, you know, things into the ingredients
table. And you end up with a lot of server round trips.
You're doing a lot of round trips in that case.
And you have to maintain your transactional consistency on the client side.
Right.
And if the connection gets dropped in the middle, you got to start over. And you know, there's a lot of things that can go wrong there.
In this case, I'm saying, you know, hey, all these 60 things are related, or the 20 things, you know, I'm changing my example on the fly just to confuse people. All 20 of these ingredients are related. I want them to go in together from a performance standpoint, and I want them to succeed or fail, you know, as a unit.
And it's a much more streamlined process from the application. It's very easy to do,
right?
From the .NET side to pass in a data table. It's extremely easy to do,
right? And data tables have been around for a while. So.
Exactly. And even if you inherit and derive your own classes from it, it's still a data table under the hood.
So with the merge statement, you know, if I'm thinking of, you know, your use case of saying file new recipe and a rich client, you know, application, I gathering all the information from the user, doing some basic validations, you know, that they've got, you know, the measurements appropriate, mm-hmm. you know, in there, you know, that you've got a cup, you know, one right. cup of, you know, flour, for instance, mm-hmm. right? I can still use the merge statement in that case because I'm going to have a data table of all this information. And I'm going to send it to the database, and it's going to treat it as all new records because they don't exist.
Right, exactly. So, yeah, I'm using the same code, whether it's a brand new recipe
or
it's something that's being edited.
That's hot.
It's great. It's,
yeah.
It saves so much because, you know, from a database developer perspective, it used to be standard practice for me to – when I create a new table, I create all the CRUD statements. I create an insert stored procedure. I create an update stored procedure. I create a delete stored procedure. Well, now I can create a stored procedure that uses merge.
Right.
So, and even if you're dealing with one row at a time, you can still use the merge statement because it's going to determine, is this one row an insert, an update, or a delete?
Cool. So before we jump off of these two interrelated things, I got to ask you specific compare and contrast, and I'm probably putting you on the spot here because I don't know how much experience you have with it, but it sounds like the merge shares, you know, overlaps a little with another technology, the 80.NET Sync framework.
I haven't dug personally into the
Sync framework. Okay, I want to make sure I didn't want to put you on the spot, but because the merge sounds very powerful for offline clients, right?
I can
pull data, I could disconnect from the network, I could hibernate my machine, I could come back to it, you know, 8-10 hours later and, you know, resync it. And the sync framework sounds like it does the same thing. I think the key difference is that with the sync framework, you have a local database. So you have that persistence. And mm-hmm. with the merge feature, it doesn't sound like that there's that companion to it.
There doesn't have to be. It from what you're saying, it sounds to me more like the sync framework would I think about over the years when I've supported different disconnected CRM applications where they stored things in their own database and then ended up coming back and do a kind of like merge replication between the disconnected client and the master database, where I could see, you know, especially since you're using data tables with merge, it'd be very easy to just, you know, for your application when it's disconnected to just persist that to disk as XML.
Right.
And, you know, read it back in. Oh, I'm connected. I'm going to update the database.
Yeah. And the 802.NET sync framework, you know, requires the local database. And usually that's, you know, a local copy, you know, of SQL, either, you know, SQL Express or SQL Everywhere, Compact Edition, whatever we're calling it this week. We've changed the name a couple of times. I'm upfront and honest about that.
It's moved around quite a bit.
Yeah.
You know, I still call SQL Server Express MSDE, so that's.
Oh, you're old school. Yeah. It requires that local copy. And what you essentially do is you say, hey, here's my server version of it. It'll create the local version of it for you. It adds a few columns in there to keep track of the information, right? And it actually adds a tombstone table in case, you know, things get deleted and you want to keep track of it. You know, it adds all that goo that normally, in the old days, we used to write all this stuff.
Right.
You talk about the disconnected client. We always used to.
It was always hard.
Yeah. It was so hard, right? Because we'd actually say, well, everybody can use an access table locally. Let me create a little MDF, you know, Microsoft access table. And I'm going to kind of make it look like, you know, the server table up there. I'll write all my code to go against that. And then I'll put a sync button, you know, in my mm-hmm. application that when I'm connected to the network, it'll actually pull the records. And you're basically rewriting merge replication, which sounds really easy when you start. But when you start dealing with the edge cases,
The edge cases are what really hurt you there because, oh, what do I do when this happens?
Right.
And when you're developing, you're thinking, oh, this isn't going to happen all that much, but that's the first call you get when you roll out your application.
Absolutely. There's never a problem when there's only one user in the application because they've made all the changes everywhere. When you get, you know, additional users in there with conflicting changes and all that, it starts getting ugly. The sync framework says all those troublesome cases, we're going to programmatically address those, and you don't have to go start designing your own table. But it sounds like merge will do some of that capabilities, but the one is really truly for disconnected persistent clients. Merge, you would still have to kind of roll your own if you wanted to persist it locally.
Right. And you know, I'm always of the opinion that if I can do something with something out of the box, like the sync framework,
yeah.
I think about the people that are working on those teams. I know they're smarter than I am. There's no way that I could beat one of them. So am I going to trust my code or theirs?
And I would say not necessarily that they're smarter than you, but that guy working on that code, that's all he's working on. You, in addition, have to solve the business problem.
Exactly.
Right. You have to create the recipe and your time is best spent on the recipe stuff, not on synchronizing a local copy of a table with a server side.
Exactly.
That is all that guy is doing.
And has been doing probably for the last 15 years to release this one product.
Right. You know, he's got that focus, that single point of view, and he's also going to take all those edge cases into account for everybody, not necessarily just, you know, your specific, you know, applications case, right?
Exactly.
All right, so next feature of SQL Server 2008 that you exploited in the recipe box.
Now we get into the interesting and more fun things. Okay, those have been traditional, you know, even without these new features, we had to deal with those types of things.
Right.
Okay. Now we're getting into, I'm going to start talking about file stream.
Okay.
And file stream is an interesting animal.
This is cool, by the way.
This, file stream
I know what you're going to talk
great.
About, so.
What FileStream allows you to do, and most people that deal with images or documents being uploaded to a website or something have done something similar to what I'm about to describe. You build an application that takes that in as a stream and stores it in the file system someplace and then writes a record to the database saying, this is what I accepted and this is the path to where I put it.
Right.
We've all done it. It's all over the place.
And just like the, hey, I'm going to write my own replication, it works fine in the normal case, the problem that you run into, because I've done this before, right? Like, well, we can't store Word documents in the database. It's, you know, they're too big, right? Mm-hmm. Why would we store blob type stuff in there? So let's put it on the file system and let's put the pointer to it. Well, what if somebody deletes it from the file system, not going through your code? The record's still in the database. The file's not there.
Exactly.
Or we mark it as delete, but something happened where it didn't actually get deleted in the file system. So we have orphan files out there that could potentially name conflict with future ones.
Exactly.
Because we're checking the table to make sure it's not named that way. We're not actually looking at the file system.
Right.
So again, you're writing all this goo code, not business code.
Exactly.
So tell us about the feature in SQL Server 2008 that moves the burden from us.
What FileStream allows you to do, and this is a great, great thing. You can say, write this out. You can write a record into the database and tell it this column should be stored in the file system, directly in the file system, not in SQL Server. So you can use a standard SQL Server insert statement to insert this binary stream, and it takes that binary stream and puts it at the file system.
And you don't do this from the code standpoint. This is at the database side, right?
The database knows where to put it.
Right.
To the code, it looks like a var binary column in a table. It looks like a blob column in a table, except that it's easier to work with than traditional blob columns. So if you do an insert statement, if you do an update, if you do a delete, you're working with it like you're working with any regular data. There's another side of FileStream that is even more interesting to developers, and that's where SQL Server will allow you to write file stream data directly to the file system. What it does, you can request a Win32 handle from SQL Server. You say, for this row of other data that I just put in, give me the Win32 handle for the file stream data. And then using any stream writer in .NET, you can write directly to the file system with that Win32 handle.
Okay.
And SQL Server manages that transactionally.
Okay.
It's still part of your database because you were given the handle by SQL Server. You can't go and access that data directly. If you do, you're going to corrupt your database and you're going to cause problems. But if you get SQL Server to give you the handle to it, you can write to it, you can read it, you can use it in your applications, you can deal with it as if it's any other file that you're writing. The only difference is SQL Server is managing it, and you no longer have the 2 gig limit that SQL Server imposes on blob data.
And the 2 gig limit, is that for the size of one file, for the
That'd
total
be for
of all
the size
files?
Of one file.
Okay, so most of the time you're not going to come close to the 2 gigabyte limit anyway, but there are definitely cases emerging.
Well, I was talking to some people down at TechEd last year, TechEd 2008, where they wanted to they were working for a media company and were interested in using FileStream for video data.
Right.
So when you get into having audio and video, you could be pushing that 2 gig limit with a single file.
Yeah,
depending on the size.
If you're talking about, you know, high def, you know, video files, you know, I'm used to the thirsty developer, right? So we deal in megabytes, not anywhere near gigabytes, you know, because we're audio and we downsample it.
But if you're working for CNN or MSNBC or something that's going to be streaming data.
Sony or Universal Pictures, somebody like that.
Exactly.
You know.
If they're using SQL Server to store that data, they're going to need more than 2 gig. File stream with the Win32 handle allows you to do that. So what I'm using it for in the application is to, and this is, I will confess this application is a work in progress as I'm doing these presentations. When it's done, I will post it to CodePlex and get the information over to Larry so that he can send it out to everyone who's interested in it.
Right.
But what we're doing is we're using it for images of the recipes.
Right. Obvious.
So you got pictures. If it's a new recipe that you've created and you take a picture of it, you upload it, the application can get a Win32 handle from SQL Server and write it directly to the file system, still maintained within a SQL Server transaction.
Now, let me ask you a quick question. The file system that he gets the handle to, does it have to be on the SQL Server?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it does.
So that would be something you'd want to, as you're planning out, you know, if you have big files, you need to make sure that you understand that it's going
over your network.
Right. Well, but the thing is, though, it could be SAN attached storage, probably.
Yes, it could.
It's just got to be physically on the same box as the SQL Server. But as we know, physical doesn't necessarily mean like attached disk, you know, in the chassis.
Exactly. but it still needs to, you know, you're going to be pumping 2 gig over your network pipe over to your SQL Server box from your app tier.
Yeah. Generally, though, you're talking about, you know, the obvious thing I'm thinking of is your web, you know, your web server writing something, you know, to your SQL Server that's running at, you know, LAN speeds. Like,
yeah,
you know,
your gigabit switch.
Gigabit switch.
Probably.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to pump that over something with a lot of latency.
No, you wouldn't.
You know, like, you know, your laptop tethered to a cell phone, you know, in a coffee shop. Yeah, that's probably not the time to be getting those handles.
I know people that tried to upload video on an unlimited data plan. That plan was no longer unlimited for them. They tried to do that. No, it didn't. It wasn't good.
Yeah, I skirt the edges of that unlimited sometimes, you know, because I'm on the road quite a bit. The plans are great because they kind of pay for themselves when you tether. Because if you look at, you know, $12 to access a hotel wireless for the day.
It's crazy.
Yeah. We're getting off topic, though.
Yes, we are.
An interesting topic to technology people. But
so that's where I'm using file streams for the images. The next and last technology that is pertinent to developers that I'm looking at, or that I'm using, not looking at using, this one I'm actually using already, is spatial data.
Right.
Now, SQL Server 2008 introduces two geospatial data types. You can have geometry or geography. Now, geometry is planar, flat coordinate system. Geography is round Earth.
Right.
So if you put in coordinates in geography and you display them, if it's a straight line in your coordinate system, it's going to display curved because it's round Earth coordinates. Now, the interesting thing about these is they were shipped. The types for these are not built into SQL Server. They're .NET data types that are shipped with SQL Server.
Okay.
So it's proving what we can do with the CLR framework inside a SQL Server. We can extend it and start using new data types and building things out. It provides a nice, rich suite of static elements about the data type as well as instance-specific elements about data types, which are really nice to work with. And the one caveat here, and this is not a problem for .NET developers but a problem for database developers, databases, if you set up a SQL Server database as case insensitive, everything is case insensitive. Your column names, your table names, it doesn't matter.
Right.
With these data types, no matter what your database is set up at, if you're calling a static method on one of the spatial data types, you have to have the case correct, just like you would in C Sharp. Otherwise, SQL Server is going to complain because it can't find the type because these are built in .NET.
That makes sense. Yeah,
it makes sense
when you think about it that way.
But from a database developer's perspective, if you're not used to having things be case sensitive, which most people that I know that are running SQL Server don't set it up as a case sensitive database.
Right.
So, you know, it's something that people have to get used to. You may be asking yourself, though, how did I incorporate spatial data into a recipe box?
I thought instantly of country of origin. You know, this is a enchilada recipe, so it would be Spain or Mexico.
And that's where a lot of people have gone with it when I first talked to them about it. I took it down to a more local level.
Okay.
When I plan a menu, I get an ingredients list.
You right.
know, I'm making these five recipes this week. Here's the list of ingredients that I've done. So how I'm using spatial data is I'm geocoding the ingredients to where they're located in my grocery store that I go to.
Are you kidding?
I am not kidding. So what I can
that,
do is...
It's that precise.
Well, I'm using geography. Pardon me. I'm using geometry, not geography.
Okay.
So basically what I'm doing is I'm taking a map of my grocery store. Most of the grocery stores you go in, they've got a map of roughly the aisles and where things are. And I'm actually plotting on this map. I just set that up as a, you know, it's 200 by 100 in planar space.
Okay.
And then I can say that this ingredient is here. This ingredient is here. So that when I go into a grocery store, and every grocery store that you go into, or at least that I go into, they route you through certain areas before you can get to the real aisles. So I have to walk through the deli and the bakery and the produce section.
Absolutely. They want to show you high margin things
exactly.
before you get to the low margin things.
So you get routed through that before you get to the real aisles in the store. So I'm taking that into account, and I'm building an algorithm that will produce this in walk order, in best walk order.
Okay.
Knowing that you come in this door, you have to go through to get to point A. You can't just, you know, come in and go right to your items. So you have to walk through these certain areas of the grocery store. But from there, what's the best route through the grocery store to get to the items that are on my shopping list?
Right.
SQL Server Management Studio has a decent interface for plotting geospatial data. So what I have it doing right now when I give this demo live is I actually run a query in Management Studio, and it plots the outline of my grocery store with the aisles, and then it plots dots for where all the ingredients that I'm going to are. So you can, you know, kind of tie it together that way. Ideally, using file stream and spatial together, you upload a map of the grocery store. You upload that map that you plotted things off of, and it would lay the spatial coordinates on top of the map so you could see it that way.
Right.
And I've been talking to different people about how could I take this to the next level? How could I extend this even further? And people have come up with some crazy, crazy ideas. You know, go into your grocery store, take pictures and geocode the pictures so that you can actually see things and you can kind of fly through the grocery store. My personal favorite was have it download to your PDA or cell phone and be able to do turn-by-turn directions. You know, in 15 feet, pick up carrots.
Right.
using the GPS in your phone.
Well, one of the first things I thought of when you were describing that is height, right?
The Z dimension.
Yeah, I must be an interesting shopper because everything that I want is on the lowest shelf or the highest shelf. And they do that on purpose because they want to put certain items at eye level.
Again, the high margin.
Well, the kind of impulse stuff. Oh, that looks pretty. Let me grab that, right? And it must be my diet. You know, I don't know if I've ever mentioned this in the show, but I'm a vegetarian. You know, so it seems like everything that I want, like garbanzo beans, are not a hot item normally, right? So they're not at eye level. They're actually down the lower shelf. And it'd be interesting to plot that as well. Does the geometry take in the Z-index? I know some of the...
It doesn't right now.
Some of the geography does, though, right?
You can use Z-index in certain cases, but this is all based on a industry standard, or not an industry standard from IT industry, but there are geospatial standards out there that this is all based on. I don't know exactly when Z-index will be truly incorporated into things. Like with what I'm doing, I'm just dealing strictly with XY coordinates.
Right, and if you can get that close, then you can scan up and down. But that opens some really cool things that you could do with it. I guess this it instantly opens you up to the age old data consistency, data freshness kind of thing because they will occasionally reorder things in a grocery store.
Exactly.
Oftentimes they'll, and actually with the end cap, it's not such a big deal because usually if something's on an end cap, it's also down another aisle.
Correct.
But, you know, there are times where they'll move stuff from one row to the next. And
well, and then the other thing is there's always another aspect to this, and this, I've thought about this. You know, maybe getting with some of the grocery store chains and saying, can you export your store in geospatial format so that, you know, you could load this up into this? And some of the local chains around here, like Roundy's or, you know, one of those chains, say, you know, if you could export that, we could load it into this so that, okay, pick which store you're going to. And these are the ingredients that I need. So in this store, this is where they are. In this store, this is where they are.
Yeah, and because this stuff is all in SQL Server, you could do some really interesting things. I'm imagining the full built out application. I don't mean to put more scope on you, but
oh no, that's what would be what it's all about. It's a community application.
What would be really neat is keeping a list of what I have in my pantry, and I could do this a couple of ways. I could say, this is what I have in my pantry. As I cook things, I'm depleting my store. You know, if it's the day before I'm going to go shopping, I'm going to say, well, gee, what recipes could I make with what I've got? That's a simple query.
Simple query. Another one that we've thought about is taking the sales circular from a particular grocery store chain and saying, what do they have on sale this week? Combine that with what do I already have? What recipes can I make? And when was the last time I had that recipe?
optimize your recipes for cost.
Exactly.
You could also look at it as the bulk of the item too. If you if you really like tapped into, you know, what the retailer had available,
weights and metrics and
right. Well,
dimensions.
Because you can buy a pound of flour for a dollar. You can buy 10 pounds of flour for like $2.
Right.
Right. Because when you start buying in bulk, the cost decreases and because you can see the overhead that they have associated with it. Right. So it could actually say that, you know, hey, based on the recipes that you like, you ought to buy this in bulk, not in the little tiny, you know, jars.
Exactly. One off-the-wall suggestion that I've gotten was, as you bring ingredients into your house, RFID them. So then you could just download your shopping list to your PDA, walk into your kitchen, scan for RFIDs. It knocks off the things that you already have.
Right.
And you can just go to the grocery store for that. Then that's a little far-fetched right now.
Right now,
maybe
yeah.
In 5 years it won't be.
Well, as the cost of RFID drops, but also that might be something that retailers do because of their own usage, you know.
Right. If they start doing that for their own inventory purposes, well, then couldn't you?
Or Microsoft Tag. You know, we were just talking about this at another call we had earlier today, is that rather than an RFID, which is a hard, you know, item, they're really tiny, but
right.
Microsoft Tag is a kind of a advanced souped up barcode, you know, that could easily go on every product.
Absolutely.
And all you would need is visibility into those things as they came in the house. It wouldn't be as cool as RFID, but you know, the cost would be a lot more reasonable.
Exactly.
Interesting. Well, Chuck, any other? I think that was all the new features you covered.
That's the features that I'm covering with the application. You know, there's a lot more features on the back end that support performance and data storage. You can compress your data internally in SQL Server.
Encrypting and on the file system is a big feature.
Yeah, transparent data encryption, where you apply a key to your database instance, then not only is your data encrypted, so if someone gets your MDF and LDF files, they can't read them, but your backups are inherently encrypted that way. So if, you know, your laptop gets stolen, you've got a backup on there. Unless they have your server's master key from the actual database server, they can't restore that backup and use it. Data compression is one that I'm really getting into these days. Native backup compression, where I just put out a blog post about that a couple days ago, because anyone with a database of any substantial size needs compression on their backups.
Right.
Up until now, you've had to buy a third-party tool. Well, now it's built into SQL Server, and it is quite good. It's comparable to the third-party tools I've evaluated. So it's very exciting for me to, you know, from the back end to be able to use those technologies. But yeah, from a developer perspective, there's some really cool stuff in there that is going to increase developer productivity and help applications just be better.
Yeah, and what I like is it's nearly the perfect release, because you get all these additional features, some of them operational, some of them developer-oriented, but for the most part, SQL Server 2005 databases, good, well-designed databases, are just going to instantly port to
very,
SQL Server 2008.
Very little learning curve, very, very little conversion, and there's a great tool that ships with SQL 2008. You can have it scan your SQL 2005 databases and tell you where things are going to fail. It's a very good tool. And
yeah, we actually had a podcast a couple of months ago about migrating from SQL Server 2005 to 2008. I'll put the link in the show notes in case somebody missed that one.
And another thing is that even when you upgrade to 2008, now in SQL Server Profiler, there's a new event class for deprecated features. So you can run this and have your applications running, and you can see it will report to you when you're using things that are deprecated in 2008 and are going to be removed from a future release.
Cool.
So, you know, there's a lot of things. You mentioned that it's kind of the ideal release. It's kind of like how SQL 2000 was to SQL 7.0. It was a lot of the same new features, enhancements, but there wasn't a huge learning curve and
right.
A huge upgrade curve. 2008 is the same way for 2005. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, that's cool. So you mentioned your blog, and you've got some great blog posts out there.
I'm building my blog up more. I haven't been quite as active as I'd like to, but I'm starting to put more and more stuff out there. I blog on a site called devplanet.com. My blog is called Me, My Database, and I.
Okay. We'll put a link to that in the show notes as
great.
Well. Wanted to thank you for your time today, Chuck.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to The Thirsty Developer. This podcast is available on the Zune Marketplace and the iTunes Music Store. You can also find a link to the feed at thirstydeveloper.com. For general comments on the show or to suggest a topic, send an email to thirstydeveloper@live.com. Or send us a message on our new Twitter account, twitter.com/thirstydev.